right. Well, not really, because we're reading Job. All is right with the world until you open this book. At that point, it's over. We are at the start of chapter 28, Perek Chavchet, if you're using the Art Scroll Stone Tanakh, page 1654-1655. This is the middle of Job's first closing address. Why do one when you can do two? Chapter 27, which we concluded last week, was his statement, which was really sort of a rehash. It didn't really present a whole lot that was new, but saying that he is just, he is never going to give in. There were elements of it that were interesting, you know, from a language perspective, or when he swore by God who has warped his judgment. But he said to the visitors, what do you gain by wickedly flattering a god? And then he said, God is going to crush wicked people. And that gave us some pause in terms of understanding. What do you mean when you say that God is going to punish wicked people? I thought you don't believe in that, Job. And we gave a few different answers. One suggestion was that perhaps he's being sarcastic, but it didn't really seem to fit. Dad Mikra said that Job was using the visitor's description of reality as a threat against them. I don't think that wicked people suffer, but according to you, they do, so guess what you have in store for you? That was Dad Mikra's approach. We saw Newsom's approach as well, that this is like what we saw in 24, in which he turns himself into a sort of art exhibit. In which he presents within his own words the two opposites that he is experiencing in his life, the belief in in righteousness and in divine power, and the belief in the corruption that is going on, and he speaks both out of his mouth to make his, to sort of confront his visitors with the contradiction. So that was chapter 27. And last week we started on chapter 28 and the unique problem that it poses. So that's what we're going to start with again today. We presented some ideas last time, but now we're going to really launch into it. The chapter presents contrasts between, in the first half, wealth, and in the second half, wisdom. Precious items, gems, pearls, those can be found. Wisdom cannot be found. Wealth, again, the gems, the pearls, the precious metals, those are all the examples. They disappear. Wisdom is forever. And then at the end, precious items are found by hard work. You may have to dig, you may have to overturn the field, but ultimately you'll find them. Wisdom requires something else. Apparently, at least according to some reads, what he says at the end is, wisdom requires reverence for God. This is a very difficult chapter in the context of the book. First of all, the language, as we said last time, is different. Whereas in the other chapters, Job spoke with a very sharp tongue, very confrontational. Here, it's just a nice mellow poem. It's you know, someone just, you know, gave Job a drink or something, and now he's much calmer. That's one. Number two is that unlike the preceding chapter, it doesn't seem to respond to a particular claim from the visitors. They didn't really talk about where you find wisdom, at least not explicitly. Maybe. But they think they do. Right? They speak from a position of, well, we have wisdom and here it is. But there was no discussion about finding wisdom. It was just assumed within their speech that, yeah, we understand what's going on. This is why God is doing it. And now, you know, take our advice. It also is odd in the sense that it talks about Yirat Hashem, reverence for God, at the end of the chapter. And that really hasn't been a theme in the book, has it? Unrighteousness has been. They've accused him of being unrighteous, and he has insisted, I am righteous. And they accused him of harming the widow and the orphan and so forth, and he said, no, I took care of them. So righteousness has been a theme, but not reverence for God. Where in the world did that come from? So we're going to answer that by the end of the chapter, if not the end of the day. So, what this is doing here, I want to present three views, although there are legion. The first view is that this chapter is about a statement of Job's righteousness. Back in chapter 27, sentence 6, he said, I maintain my righteousness. I am righteous and I continue to conduct myself righteously. Doing right is what matters. And fundamentally, if you want to know what wisdom is about, wisdom equals Torah. That's Rashi's understanding of what's going on in this chapter. Notwithstanding that it doesn't seem to fit with what we've been discussing in the book, it fits in the sense that it's an outgrowth of the statement of I am still righteous, and now I'm going to talk about righteousness. That's one way to look at it. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number one, where I brought you a quote from Rashi to show this. He says, Gam ze tam acher ledvarav harishon shamar b'tzid kasi hechazakti. This is another reason for his preceding statement when he said, I maintain my righteousness, meaning it's along those lines. Ki lama ehyeh rasha. What he says in this chapter is, you want to know why I'm righteous? There's no percentage in being wicked. What for? Im bishvil kesef v'zahav, if it's just for the silver and gold, v'kol yesh motzav aso, everything has an origin, you can mine the metals, and everything has an end, and it's destroyed, and therefore it's not worthwhile. So Job is saying in this chapter, you want to know why I'm righteous? There's no percentage in anything else. What I should be doing is pursuing righteousness. That is what has value. And if you take a look at source number 2, Rashi in sentence 12, where Job is going to begin talking about wisdom, says explicitly what he thinks this wisdom is, the ha-chokhma, ha-Torah. The wisdom that is referred to in the chapter is Torah. That's what it is. So Rashi is very clear in his read of what's going on here. Are we clear on that? Good? Yes.
It may be coincidence, but the expression kesef zahav reminds me of Balak, where Bilam twice says,
Yeah. Well, it's certainly something which, and certainly within Rashi, is something which is looked down upon. In other words, when you speak of silver and gold, it's understood you're speaking of something that other people value, but we view as being inferior and really beneath human pursuit. It's not something you should be endeavoring to find. Yes, I think, and that's very much so in the context of Bilam.
Yes.
Yeah, he's cheapened himself by selling out, essentially, to Balak. By the way, I apologize for the fact that the sheets that I printed have a little bit of a fade in the middle there. I realized after I printed them that the toner was low, but next time. In any case, the digital version that appears on your computer has no fade on it. So that's Rashi's take. I seek Torah. I need righteousness. I pursue. I pursue righteousness, and all this other, all the other material concerns are insignificant to me. Clear? Okay, that's one read. There are weaknesses within the read. We still have the problem that it doesn't seem to fit the tone of the rest of the book. Meaning, if this had appeared in any other chapter, what Job would have said to them was, I am righteous, you guys are not righteous, you're probably interested in wealth, which I reject. It would have been very confrontational, it would have been very harsh, and here is this very mellow poem, as we're going to see. So it's still hard to see that within what's being said here. A second view, and this is the approach that Ibn Ezra takes in his summary of the message of the book at the end of the book, he says, you keep telling me why I'm experiencing what I'm experiencing, but no one can understand why I am experiencing this. Wisdom cannot be found. And his use of wisdom doesn't mean, as Rashi thinks, wisdom equals Torah, but wisdom means the possibility of comprehending how the world works, what God does. Which is, I think, the conventional way to read this chapter. In other words, it is a response to what came before. Every time the visitors say to Job, this is why you are suffering, they're saying, here is wisdom. We are going to teach you the way the world works. And Job's response, per Ibn Ezra, is, you don't know the way the world works. You want to know how to find gems? I can tell you how to find gems. You want to know how to find gold and silver? I can tell you where to find gold and silver. But you're never going to find wisdom because it's not there to be found. The best you can do is have reverence for God. That's the best you can do. And that's why Ibn Ezra reads the chapter. If you take a look in source number 3, I showed you from Ibn Ezra, Dat Mikra is along these lines as well. But take a look at what you have here in number 3. He says, Hashem yase ritzono, ye'aneh rasha gam tzadik. God performs his will. He oppresses wicked and righteous alike. Gam yesh tzadikim, gam rishim sheyiten lahem kol tov sheyitavu. And he says there are good people and there are bad people to whom God gives whatever they desire. We can't find rhyme or reason in the way things happen. Veladas zos ha-chokhma, and to comprehend this wisdom, lama zeh, why this happens, nisgava midat b'nei adam, is beyond human ken. Forget it, you're not going to know it. V'hine, hatam kasher lo ye'u b'nei adam machshavot Hashem u'gzerotav shem amukot. He says, just as people can't know what God thinks and what God decrees, it's too deep. Ulai ela gzerot shegazar alai hu yeda lama gzaram ve'inam bavushachatati lefanav. He says, the decrees that God has issued against me, maybe God knows why he's done it. But you can't know. You don't know why God does what he does. And that is Ibn Ezra's read. That's the Mikra's read as well of the message of the chapter. So two very different messages already between Rashi and Ibn Ezra. Right? Rashi is saying, Torah is the answer, and that's what I seek to know, and that's the righteousness that I pursue. And it's all about my personal behavior and explaining who I am. That's what Job is trying to do. Whereas, Ibn Ezra, in contrast, says, no, this is actually part of the dialogue with the visitors. You wanted to tell me how the world works, and I'm telling you that you don't have a clue how the world works, and neither do I. Only God knows, which is why I am trying to sue God for, you know, what's the term they use when reporters, Freedom of Information Act, right? I'm suing God under the Freedom of Information Act for him to explain to me what exactly led to the decision that he made. Okay, that's the second take. And then the third take I'm bringing here is Newsom. And I think this is brilliant for a reason that we won't get to yet. It's at the end of the chapter, but I'm saving it. But what Newsom suggests is that this is not Eov speaking at all. This isn't Job. This is the book addressing us. In other words, Job spoke in chapter 27, and now the book is speaking to us and trying to convey a message, which is a comment on the dialogue. And the way she frames it is she uses two different terms. One is a wisdom dialogue, and the other is a wisdom poem. What we've seen, ever since chapter 3, has been a wisdom dialogue. It's a dialogue about wisdom. You say one thing, I say something back. You say another thing, I say something back. And we try to come to understanding and wisdom, and the result has been not so much, right? It hasn't exactly worked. The wisdom poem is what we're seeing in chapter 28, and it is a comment on what came before, saying debating wisdom is useless and it provides nothing. And in fact, it harks back to the very beginning of the book. The very beginning of the book, the part that she calls the prose tale, right? Because it's the part that's in prose. The story of Job and how he's so righteous and wonderful, and then he gets zapped because of this, you know, because the Satan comes to God and says people are horrible, and God says, I'll prove to you people are wonderful. That whole story, as presented there, teaches us that wisdom is about living a good life. It's not about having understanding of what's going on in the world. Living righteously is wisdom, effectively. And that's the message of the chapter. She sees it. Take a look at source number 4, please. She writes, perhaps the dialogic engagement between the wisdom poem and what precedes, however, is better taken not so much as an attempt to interpret and respond to the particular participants. It's not about saying Eliphaz said this, I'm going to say that, as to the genre of the wisdom dialogue itself. The placement of the wisdom poem suggests that the poem views the wisdom dialogue as a type of futile and misguided quest for wisdom. What you spent all this time debating, that doesn't mean we wasted the last year and a half, don't get me wrong, but it's not going to bring you to a true comprehension of how the world works. We have all sorts of interesting ideas that are floated out there and that are put forth, some more than once. But ultimately, it's not going to lead you to a conclusion. No one's going to win. But the dialogic relationship between the genres might be more subtle than that. The wisdom dialogue as a genre is itself something of an exposé of the limits of the human capacity to know. Right? All of this debating says something to you, since it doesn't end in a single solution or insight into the problem it addresses. Its participants do not finally find wisdom or the place of understanding. In that regard, the wisdom poem might be seen as simply drawing a conclusion implicit in the wisdom dialogue as a generic form. In other words, what's being said here, what she's trying to put forth is, the goal of this poem is to say, all the stuff that you've been doing, this whole back and forth dialogue, doesn't take you to wisdom. What does take you to wisdom? What is wisdom? That's going to come at the end of the chapter. I'm not bringing her comment on that yet because it has a surprise in it that I don't want to say. So don't read source number, whatever it is. Yeah. Where there is wisdom is in what's at the end, this idea of Yirat Hashem, reverence for God, but we're going to see exactly what that means and how it fits when we get to the end of the chapter. But those are three different views of what's going on. Number one, the view of Rashi, that what we're trying to say here is that this is why I am righteous, Job is saying. I am righteous because righteousness has value. The pursuit of wealth doesn't interest me. It has no point. I want to be righteous because this is what is valuable, and it comes about via the chokhmah, the wisdom, that is Torah. That's Rashi. Ibn Ezra's statement is that this is a response to the visitors, saying, stop trying to be wise and tell me wisdom. You don't have wisdom. I don't have wisdom. The only one who has it is God. So we're not privy to what's going on, and you don't know why I am suffering. It's just part of the debate. Ibn Ezra's reading it as part of the book. And then you have this third approach that says that it's a comment on the fact that the dialogue has been doomed from the start. The dialogue doesn't work. At the end of the day, this isn't how you get wisdom, because you can't get wisdom in the sense of knowledge. Rather, you can live wisdom. And again, you'll see what that means when we get to the end of the chapter. Clear? Somewhat? Yes?
Is there anywhere else where the writer intersperses something like it? She said this is the writer, this is not Eov, this is not the dialogue, this is the...
Chumash does it all the time.
No, but here in Eov.
Right, in Eov, no. We have not... Well, unless you view the narration in the beginning.
Well, but that's
right, which describes Job and told his story.
But that's very narrative, it's very...
Correct. It's not presenting a message to the reader.
It's not a message.
Right.
It's just telling what happened. This is the only place in Eov that...
So far.
I
don't know. I'm up to chapter 28. Don't ask me any questions after chapter 28.
I just wanted you to have reason to think that it's the...
Oh, well, the reason for arguing that this is separate is simply the style of it, and fundamentally the message that's being said doesn't fit in Job's mouth. You know, unless you take Ibn Ezra, Rashi, and so forth. But it's... Right.
Ibn Ezra's a rebuke to his friends. It's
right.
Like, you know,
right. Right. Well, the challenge to Ibn Ezra is at the ending of the chapter, in which he says that Job is saying the best that human beings can do is to sort of rely on God, you know, and have reverence for God. Is not something I would have expected. Excuse me. It's not something I would have expected to hear him say based on everything he has said to this point. It doesn't seem to be his headspace right now. So that's one of the reasons this is really challenging, and it's not presented in his voice. His voice is a much harsher voice, and has been for many chapters. Debbie, you were going to say?
Well, I'm missing something. Hello. Does Carol Newsom have no God in it?
Oh, she does. I just didn't bring her part of the at the end.
Okay, so if I read it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it's...
So don't do that.
She's not discounting.
Right.
That's part of this.
Yeah, no. God is very... You can't leave him out. The whole end of the chapter is that.
Well, in every Torah class, he's a good atheist.
Nonetheless, you have to explain the verses that deal with God. That's still required. Okay, so let's see what happens in the chapter itself. We've talked about the chapter. So the first half of it, sentences 1 to 11, are about the search for wealth, precious metals, minerals, and the statement that they're available, but they come to destruction. There will be certain verses here which admit of multiple readings, like everything else that we've seen in the book. I'm going to try to keep it relatively simple because I want to keep our eyes on the message that the chapter is giving, rather than get bogged down in a particular word or a particular image. Good luck. So, sentence 1. Kiyesh la kesef motza. We're on page 1655 if you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh. Kiyesh la kesef motza. Umakom la zahav yazoku. There is a place from which silver is drawn, from which it is mined. There is a place in which gold is purified, is refined. Barzel me'afar yukach. Iron is taken from the soil. Ve'eben yatsuk nechusha, and stone will be melted down to produce copper. I don't think you actually melt down stone per se to produce copper. You may put the copper ore or something in a fire as part of a purification process. I wouldn't get hung up on it. The statement continues now that he has talked about precious items that are sought and found everywhere, he enumerates the places where precious items are found as well as destroyed. So he says, Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, Kates sam lachoshech, ulachol tachlis huchoker, even ofel vitzalmavis. This is one of those verses that's a challenging verse to read, mostly because it has a pronoun which doesn't provide an antecedent. In other words, Kates sam lachoshech literally translates to, he placed an end to the darkness. Who's he? So the article is very helpful. It says he. However, later in the chapter, it says he with a capital H. So therefore, the he is God. And that's one way to read it, certainly. And it's a statement that God has placed an end to the darkness, investigating every limit and finding the stones that are hidden in the dark. There are some who view the end as spatial, there are some who view the end as temporal, meaning Rashi says, a physical place. There's an end to the world where the darkness begins. Mitzudat David says, it's an end in the sense of something being terminal. God has placed an end to the darkness, meaning there's a point where at which everything is going to end, including all the wealth, including the precious metals, everything will come to a conclusion. Carla?
So Sino has man.
Right, so that's the other way you can read it, is that the Kate Sum is referring to the human being who is searching for wealth. And what it's saying is, Kate Sum Lachosha, he puts an end to the darkness, meaning that the human being goes to the farthest reaches in the search for silver, gold, gems, whatever it is. And yes, you can read the section that way just as well. And frankly, sentence 4 will seem to be that way. Sentence 4 will seem to be referring to the human being who is looking for these things. Even if you take Rashi's read, I think you have to say that sentence 4 is already he with a lowercase h. But let's see. Paratz nachal me'im gar. Actually, you don't have to read it that way according to Rashi. There is another way. Sorry. Paratz nachal me'im gar. Hanishkachim mini ragel dalu me'enosh na'u. Either you read this as the explorer, the person who's searching for wealth, he breaks forth the nachal. A nachal is a wadi, generally speaking. It's an area that does not have a natural source of water. However, when it rains, then it floods. Then this area floods. Nachal is often a wadi. So, paratz nachal, one way to read this is, the explorer who's looking for wealth, he digs in the wadi, me'im gar, the place where there is no gar, the place where nobody lives. Hanishkachim mini ragel, the place where there is no traveler. Dalu me'enosh na'u. They, meaning the explorers there, they're far from where people wander. So that's one way to read it. Another way you could read it is that it's, as they do here in the Art Scroll, the river itself bursts forth, as they put it here, from its normal flow, and it goes to a place that is unknown to human beings, in which case it's just describing the places where wealth will be found. Look, the river bursts forth, and there you will, and there are, that's where the gems are. Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. Eretz mimena yetze lachem, the land from which bread emerges, visachteha nepach kimo esh. And beneath it is overturned like fire, mikom sapir avaneha, the place of the sapphire, are its stones, ve'af roses ahav lo, and as dirt of gold. What in the world is going on in sentences 5 and 6? Do something with that. What would you do? The land from which bread emerges. What does that mean? What is that?
British Island.
It's a field. Right? It's a field. The place where you plant wheat and the wheat emerges and that's how you get bread. The land from which bread emerges, below it is overturned like fire. So one suggestion would be that what it's saying is there is land that people think they know. They work it and they get bread there. But beneath it is the ore, which you use a fire to refine and to purify. And what he's saying is that that's where the gems are hiding. That's where the gold is going to be found, beneath this field where people unsuspectingly are just planting wheat. That's one way to read it.
You know, there's this a-hole undertone on the current.
Meaning?
Destruction.
So that's Mitzudat David's read of it. Mitzudat David takes it that way and says, what it's saying here is, the land from which the bread emerges is going to come to destruction, ultimately. This idea of being overturned with fire is going to lead to sentence 7, which is going to say, take a look at it, Nasiv lo yida'o ayit, the path that was not known by the ayit. Anybody remember where the ayit shows up in Chumash? Right, the covenant between the pieces, pact between the parts. I guess you can have multiple names for it. Brit Bein HaBetarim. That's good because you save the alliteration by doing pact between the parts. The ayat is the bird that descends upon the animals that Avram has cut up at this covenant that he makes with God. So this ayat is some kind of a scavenging bird or perhaps a predatory bird, a path which even the scavenger or the predator is not aware of. That's what this field is going to become when it's consumed by fire. V'lo shezafatu ein ayah. It had never been seen by the eye of the ayah. The ayah they render here as a vulture. They have the ayah as a buzzard and the ayah as a vulture. These are scavenging birds. And it's never been seen even by the scavengers. Lo hidrichuhu b'nei shachatz. One more sentence. The children of the shachatz have never gone there. Lo adal of shachal. The shachal has not passed there. The Talmud has multiple words that it identifies from Tanakh that refer to lions of different ages or genders, and it takes shachatz and shachal both as lions. That's one explanation certainly that could be offered. There are other things you could say. Carly, you've been waiting.
Just that I read a take on the Salah has also a connotation of Sodom and the destruction there, and that it usually is used for this kind of destruction.
Right.
So it basically juxtaposes the destruction of human endeavors.
Right.
And on the other hand, also compares all the allusions to gemstones and precious metals to certain depictions of Gan Eden, which,
right,
like any fresco, for instance, where it is shown,
right,
with gemstones.
Right. Interesting. So it's the contrast of Sodom and the Gan Eden. Interesting. Good. Thank you. Who are they quoting, or is that their own there?
Actually, it's an article by Stephen Geller.
Oh,
which I think,
okay,
Newsom also references.
Got it. Okay. So I had a few articles on different wisdom elements. I just didn't get to them. So thank you. The statement here, what we're trying to say here is that either the field where the wealth had been is destroyed and overturned, in which case it's one long image, or alternatively, first we said that they're found beneath the field, and now we're just mentioning another place, which is the road that nobody travels, right? The road less traveled has gems and such there as well. The couple of just interesting notes on this. The birds that are mentioned here. So the ayah is an interesting bird as it's used here, because take a look, please, at source number 5. Source number 5 is solving a problem. And since we have the Tanakh here, we'll take advantage of it. Turn, please, to Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 11, sentence 14. There are two places in Chumash where we get the list of the kosher and non-kosher creatures. One is Parshat Shemini, which we're going to look at now. The other is Parshat Re'eh, which we'll look at in a moment. So what you want is page 269. Hebrew and English are the same here, so it really doesn't make a difference. Look at verse 14. We're listing the birds that are considered non-kosher. Okay, the Torah lists the non-kosher birds. And if you look at sentence 14, it lists the da'a and the ayah. Got it? Da'a is a non-kosher bird. Ayah is a non-kosher bird. Now, take a look. You might want to keep the page. At Devarim, Deuteronomy, chapter 14, sentence 13. That's the other list of the non-kosher birds. It is on page 463. Towards the bottom, and it says the ra'ah, the ayah, and the da'yah according to its kind. So what's the difference between what you saw in Leviticus on page 269 and what you see in Deuteronomy on page 463? The first verse said da'ah and ayah. The second one adds a bird, ra'ah as well. Not ra'ah with an ayin meaning bad, ra'ah with an aleph. So the question that the Talmud is bothered by is, what happened to the ra'ah? If the ra'ah is a non-kosher bird, it should have appeared in the first list also. It's a very dangerous thing to publish a list of these are the non-kosher ones and leave one out. Right? How can it be that Deuteronomy is aware of a non-kosher bird and Leviticus is unaware of the non-kosher bird? So, the Talmud offers an answer, and that's source number 5. Yeah.
There is another inconsistency. Racham.
Right. There are numerous. I'm only dealing with one issue right now. If we were studying these parshiot, we could go into this in depth. There are other issues here. So Rabbi Abahu gives you an answer. Amar Rabbi Abahu Ra'a Zu'ayah. He says it's one bird that is known by multiple names, which is not news. That happens in cultures all the time, that you can have a certain creature that some people call one thing and some people call another thing. So he says, Ra'a and Ayah are the same bird, fundamentally. Then why is it called Ra'a? If it's an Ayah, which is what you seem to think is the core name, because that's the one that showed up in the first list, why is it that it also has this name Ra'a? Shero'a bioter, because it has extraordinary sight, extraordinary vision. And he quotes our verse, right? Chapter 28, sentence 7, the path that has not been known by the ayat, that has not been seen by the ayah. And then it says, Tana, we have learned, Omedet bibavel, v'ro'an nevela be'eretz Yisrael. It stands in Babylon, and it can see a corpse all the way in Israel. This is used for moral messages and Musar messages about the fact that, you know, some people can see problems wherever they look. And they have great vision when it comes to finding something that they don't like. However, that's taking it out of context. In context, the nevela is not a bad thing. The nevela is dinner. Right? The statement is, from far away, it can find the next meal that it's going to scavenge. It's not meant as a negative in context. But the point that I wanted to show you is that what the Talmud is recognizing in our verse is not just this is a path that is unknown to this bird and never seen by that bird, but these are birds of great sight. These are birds that see well. And yet, they don't know about this. They don't know. That's how well hidden the gems are. One other note: there's a name of a book that emerges from this sentence. Anybody at all familiar with the book Ein Ayah? Ein Ayah is Rav Kook's commentary to the Medrash that's recorded in the book called Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov is a collection of Agadata, passages from the Talmud that have stories, that have lessons that are not lessons of halakha, that are not of Jewish law. They're collected in Ein Yaakov. So Rav Kook wrote a commentary to it called Ein Ayah. And he says he used this name, the eye of the ayah, because he says, I don't really know chokhmah, I don't know wisdom. So it makes sense for me to draw the image of this chapter, which talks about how human beings can't find wisdom. So he takes it from here. That's what he drew on. In any case, we're going back into the theme of where we are. Again, it's page 1655 in the Stone Tanakh. We're talking about places that are far-flung, that are not necessarily well traveled, but that's where the gems are, and that's where the precious metals are, and people will overturn them looking for them, or potentially, as Jules noted, the other layer here, which Mitzudat David talks about, the destructive layer. How all of this ultimately will come to destruction, perhaps the stone image of being overturned with fire. So we're up to sentence 9. Bachalamish shalach yado hafach mishoresh harim. So once again, we come back to the question of who the pronoun it is. Is it God or is it the explorer? You could really use either one. But whoever it is sends his hand, his capital H or his lowercase h, among the chalamish. Chalamish are usually boulders. Hafach mishoresh harim, he overturns mountains from their roots. He uproots the mountain, in other words. Either seeking wealth or destroying wealth. Batsurot yeorim bikea, v'chol yekar ra'ata'eno. So, among these stones of the Yaor, what's a Yaor?
A river.
A river, right. It's a term we use in Egypt for the Nile. Batsurot yeorim bikea, he splits the stones of the rivers. V'chol yekar ra'ata'eno, everything that is valuable, his eyes see. Mibchi naharot chibesh, v'ta'aluma yotzi or. He bandages, meaning he binds up the rivers. Don't get confused by the word bechi; it doesn't mean tears. How do they render it here? I hope they didn't use tears. They actually say fashioned rivers. Interesting, but it's the waters of the deep. In other words, we'll see it actually in chapter 38. God willing. The use of the term nivche yam. It just means the waves, the depths. So, v'taluma yotzi or, that which had been hidden in it, he brings to light. So either this is about the extent to which the explorer goes and hunts these things in all far-flung places, or it's about God's awareness of where all of these are and potentially destroying the wealth. But that's the first half of the chapter. It's relatively straightforward, even if there are a couple of verses that demand more exploration. Then you take a look at the second half. He says, V'ha'chokma me'ayin timatze ve'eze mekom bina. Where in the world is wisdom going to be found? What is the place of understanding? Lo yadayin osh erka. Nobody knows the nature of wisdom. No human being knows the nature of wisdom. Erech is usually a term for value. But as it's used in this chapter, I think it's more like the true nature of something. People don't know the nature of wisdom. Velo si matzei be'eretz hachayim. It will not be found in the land of the living. The land of the living, the simple meaning of that means all the other verses that we just read. Right? The land inhabited by the people, the fields, the birds, whatever it is, it's not going to be found there. All those places where the wealth is, that's not where you're going to find, that's not where you're going to find wisdom. It's just not to be found there. If you take a look at source number 7, I'm jumping Mitzudat David in number 6. Mitzudat David continues with his theme about something, about wealth being destroyed, and he says wisdom cannot be destroyed. It endures forever. But in number 7, Rashi says, V'lo timatzei be'eretz hachayim, it will not be found in the land of the living, b'misha mechayeh, meaning someone who gives himself life. He says, you want to know who will have wisdom? Somebody who is willing to kill himself for it. Someone who's willing to give his life for it. Because remember, Rashi's read of the chapter is not that wisdom can't be found. Rashi said that what Job is trying to say is that wisdom is Torah. So what do you mean when you say it can't be found in the land of the living? Rashi has a problem. So his answer is, not that it can't be found in the land of the living, the earth, it can't be found among those who are looking to have a good time. If you want to live it up, as the phrase goes, then forget it, you're not going to find Torah. You have to be willing to deprive yourself in order to find it. This is not only seen here. This is a theme that's popular in Midrash. The most famous example is Parshat Chukat, probably, when they're talking about the laws of Tum'ah, the laws of ritual impurity, and what happens if somebody passes away and impurity being communicated in the building. It says, Zot HaTorah, Adam Ki Amud Ba'ohel. This is, literally, this is the law of when a person dies in the tent. But the Midrash picks up on the introduction of Zot HaTorah. This is the Torah. Adam ki amut ba'ohel, when one is willing to die in the tent of Torah, then that person will gain a Torah, will find a Torah. So that's the way Rashi reads this here. It's not saying wisdom can't be found anywhere in the land. It's saying wisdom can't be found by people who are instead trying to have a good life. They're not really going to be the ones who are going to find it. You follow? Different layers in reading this passage. So he says, it's not going to be found in the land of the living, whatever that means. Sentence 14, Tahom Amar Lo Vihi. The depths say, I don't have it. V'yam Amar Eini Madi. The sea says, it's not with me. That's weird, no? We have not yet seen in this chapter personification of geological formations. Right? We've talked about them. The whole chapter has been filled with them. But until now, they didn't have the ability to speak. So what do I make of this?
He's introducing anthropomorphisms.
Yes, but out of nowhere. In other words, what moved him to say that for the depths and the sea in particular? So,
well,
yeah.
Speaking about water in the broadest sense.
But why have it speak? He didn't. When he talked about the Nachal, he didn't have the Nachal speak.
Well,
river or what?
It just got somewhere.
Yeah, and sentence 14 seemed like a good place.
And the, you go a few lines further, you will have personified destruction in this.
Yes, but that's easier for me than a geological feature.
Well, the deep is also the cosmic deep, the cosmic ocean, and the deep could be Sheol.
The deep, and therefore it's not a physical thing at all.
No.
Even though it's presented with the yam, which...
Well, the yam,
unless it's Saro Shel Yam, the agent of the sea, which we've talked about earlier
in
the book.
The yam is also like an ancient personified opponent of Hashem, which is being subdued.
Okay, I'm going to say that as a simple reader, I wouldn't take into home that way. But I understand what you're saying. There is this, this idea that Yam certainly and maybe Tahom can then gain some kind of personality. The sages are troubled by it also, and they come up with a fascinating passage that, generally speaking, people read and say, "I don't know what that means." Which is good because we're learning Job anyway, and we're learning a chapter that says there is no wisdom. So why not? Why not read it? So source number 8, the Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, the English is on the top of the other. It's in the middle of a passage which should be familiar with in general. If you ever want to find the Midrashim that surround the presentation of the Torah, your main place in the Talmud to look is this page in Shabbat. This is an expanse of a couple of pages in which you find the discussion of the chronology of when the Jews arrived at Sinai, what they did for the days leading up to it, what day the Torah was given, the whole piece is there in this section in Shabbat. So, V'amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, in this sequence of comments that appear there, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said the following, B'shah sheyarad Moshe milifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when Moshe descended from before God, meaning Moshe has gone down the mountain already to the Jews, Bas Satan, along comes Satan, there's another connection to Job, V'amar lefanav, and he says to God, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Torah Heichani, where'd the Torah go? He says, Amar lo netati al haaretz, and God said, well, I gave it to the earth. Halach etzel eretz, so Satan goes to the earth. And Amar lo, he said to her, Torah Heichani, where's the Torah? Amar lo, to which it responded with a verse from our chapter, Elokim hevin darka. We didn't get to that verse yet. It's coming. God knows the path of wisdom. God knows where Torah is. Halach etzel yam, so he goes to the sea. Va'amar lo ein imadi. And it says, it's not with me. Hence the verse that describes the sea actually speaking, because there's a conversation. Because the Satan, which as far as we know, is, you know, just as capable of speech as the sea, the Satan says to the sea, where is the Torah? And the sea responds, shrug, not with me. Halach eitz al tahom, goes to the depths. Amar lo ein bi, it's not with me. Shneamar, and he quotes our verse. Tahom amar lo bihi, yam amar eini madi. And indeed, death and destruction, the next piece of it, right? Avadon v'mavet amruba znenu shamanu shima. Destruction and death also say, it's sentence 22 in the chapter, we have heard of it with our ears, but we don't actually know where it is. So that's how the Talmud makes sense of all of these being personified. The Chazav Amar Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so the Satan goes back to God and says, you tricked me. Where is it? So, Ribbono Shel Olam, Chipasti B'chol Haaretz V'lo Metzatiya. I searched the entire land. I didn't find it. So, Amar Lo, Lech Etzel Ben Amram. So God says, go to Moshe. Right? Why he calls Moshe son of Amram is its own discussion for another time. It's fascinating to see where Moshe gets the title son of Amram versus where he gets the title Moshe. But that's what God says to him. What in the world is the message here? What are they seeing here? What are they trying to tell us? We know where this medrash is coming from. It's coming from the fact that only in these features do we find personification of the feature where it's having a conversation. And why would they be saying, it's not in me, if not that someone asked them, where is it? And so we're connecting it to this idea that somebody doesn't know that human beings have received the Torah and is inquiring, where is it? But what in the world does that mean? Yeah?
Maybe there is a very deep meaning, the word imadi. If at the moment when Yaakov is being confronted with Lavan, he says, ya imadi.
Yeah.
Shelter versus lo imadi, despair.
Yeah, but Yaakov uses imadi multiple times. He uses it also when he's asked where the trafim are, right? And he says, you know, whatever you find imadi, whatever you find of yours, that is imadi, kachlach, take it, you know, take it, it's yours. I wouldn't necessarily read much into his use of the word imadi, necessarily. Shana?
So there are a couple of things that occurred to me. One is, I was hunting for it at the end of the Sefer Devarim, and I found it today, in chapter 30, when God says, this is far from you. Lo v'shamayim, he is known in the heavens.
Right.
Lo me'ever hayam, it's not across the sea.
Right.
Right. So we have that sense that these are good places to look for the Torah. You might have expected to find them there.
Right.
And that God comes to tell you no.
Good. So that adds to the basis for the Medrash, that passage there. Good.
And the other thing that is also in the same vicinity is that you have this place where God says, I'm making heaven and earth with witnesses against you.
Right.
So we have a sense that the physical universe is going to be witness, testimony, testifying about Israel's conduct, and so speak, they have to swear on the Torah. They become.
But they don't have it.
They are custodians of it in a sense.
What will you do with the Yam and the Dahom, which I don't think are called to be witnesses? It's really Shemayim and Aretz. Yeah.
In the sense of, you know, the idea of geological elements being called upon.
Right. Okay. I like the Lo b'shamayim here. I'm not so sure about the testimony part, but I don't know. The other problem with this is that the whole story makes no sense. Right? The reader was on it. The whole story makes no sense. What does that mean? Hashem taught Moshe the Torah. Therefore, it's no longer. Is this a physical object? What does that mean? I mean, we know Moshe goes down with the tablets. He hasn't taken the Torah with him. What does that even mean? I mean, we have a whole problem with this in terms of intellectual property rights. All he did was copy it, but the original's still there. You know, is this the problem? This is the government's copyright office that is now coming after Moshe. How do we understand this story at all? So Mitzudat David, take a look in source number 9, offers us an approach. He says, "V'hu derech haflaga umilitza." This is, the best translation I could do for haflaga and militza was, this is an exaggeration and it's a figure of speech. Lomar, she'ein lahasig omek ha'chochma, af mishtadel harbe lachzor achareha. You're not going to achieve the depths of wisdom. You're not going to grasp it, no matter how much you go looking for it. Im lo yikne mitchila yiras Hashem, unless you first acquire reverence for God, like Ben Amram, like Moshe has. The statement that's being made is that Hashem chooses to give the Torah to human beings. It's not about the location in which the Torah resides. It's about the holder of it. And if you want to find it, you have to go to Ben Amram, learn from Ben Amram how to be somebody who is worthy of Torah. And the Satan is saying, where is this wisdom? And God is saying, it's with one who has these traits. That's why Mitzudat David understands what this Gemara is trying to do. In context, though, in chapter 28, the message that we're getting with this, the deaf say, we don't know where it is, Rashi offers you two explanations. One explanation is, what I think is the simplest read, which is that the merchants who go off to sea don't have it. It's not talking about the sea per se, but it's the merchants who go off to sea. And then the other approach he offers is this passage in the Talmud saying Torah is not found there either, because remember, Rashi believes the wisdom that we're looking for here is a reference to Torah. So what we have, to sum up where we are so far, is that wealth is to be found, although you'll have to dig for it. You have to go to distant, far-flung places. Maybe also that wealth is up for destruction. Wisdom, on the other hand, people don't know its true nature. It can't be found in the depths. It can't be found in the sea. It can't be found in the land of the living. And then it continues in Pasuk Tedvav, sentence 15. He's going to talk about how wisdom is beyond compare. Lo yutan sigor tachteha, velo yishakel kesef mechira. Sigur cannot be given in its place. So they translate here sigur as precious gold. And indeed, the passage in the Talmud does so. Yuma Memhei says that that sigur is a reference to extremely valuable gold. Why in the world should the word sigur be associated with gold? What does sagur mean?
Closed.
Closed up, right. So how would that connect to valuable gold? You hide it away in a vault, maybe? Sorry?
Not easily found,
potentially. I looked in Tur Sinai, and he suggests that a vein of gold found in a rock, as opposed to the grains that you'll find in a river. Something that's sealed away in a rock. Maybe that will be more pure, or maybe it'll be more valuable. The Gemara in Yuma suggests this idea that it's when the market, when this gold is brought out to the market, all the other stores close. This is the only one that people are interested in. But Rashi, not here, but Rashi in Malachim Aleph suggests that Sagur, Zahav Sagur, means that people lock it up in a vault. They keep it for themselves. They don't put it up for trade or barter or sale. So what he's saying is, even that most valuable gold cannot be exchanged for wisdom. Yes?
I'm just thinking, when you're talking about wisdom, this thought comes to my mind. That is somewhere written that we say, teach me the number of my days that I may achieve a heart of wisdom.
Of wisdom, yes.
Wisdom isn't really the brain, it's in the heart, in some emotion.
Right, so you're making a distinction, which I think we do, of distinguishing between brain and heart as between intellect and emotion. However, within Tanakh, very often the two are blended. Yeah, they're considered to be rooted together, which I think science is coming back to, by the way. The idea that emotion and intellect are not necessarily meant to be divided. But the way we look at it, we would distinguish between the head and the heart. You're right. That's certainly what we tend to do. Continuing in the chapter, just because I want to make sure at least to finish this piece of the chapter. He's talking about how the value of wisdom is beyond compare. So the gold, forget it. Lo yishakel kesef mechira. Silver will not be taken as its price. Lo sisule bechesem ofir b'shoham yakar v'sapir. Kedem ofir is another term that we use for gold. The Shoham is a gem. It's one of the gems that are in the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, correct? The Sapir as well is another one of those gems, presumably sapphire. It should not be praised. Wisdom should not be praised as being the equal of these things. It is greater than them. Lo yarchena zahav uzechochit. Gold, fine glass, are also not its equal. Utmurasa klipaz, vessels of gold should not be equated with it either, this elevated merchandise that we're talking about. Ramot vigavish, lo yizacher, ramot, things that are elevated, that's the valuable merchandise line. The Mikra connects it to a verse in Yechezkel, chapter 27, sentence 16. I'm not going to go there right now. But it's something of elevated value. Ramot, like to be up, to be elevated. And Gavish as well, he suggests, are beautiful stones. They should not even be mentioned. Umeshech Chochma Mipninim. Meshech Chochma is greater than, the flow of wisdom is greater than pearls. And once again, Meshech Chochma is... like with Einaya, the name of a sefer, right? Rabbi Meir Simcha Kohen of Divinsk named his commentary to the Chumash Meshech Chochma, this flow of wisdom, drawing on the pasuk in Iyov, drawing the verse of in Iyov. I see here that the art school renders Meshech Chochma as the pursuit of wisdom. I like that. Okay, Rita.
Does this don't claim to study Torah, like Rabbi Meir, you know?
That's certainly the way that Rashi is reading it. That this is the pursuit of Torah.
And Joel has studied Torah, he's a student of Torah.
Yeah, that's the way, that is Rashi's take, yes. Lo ya'archena pitadat kush, the pitada, which is another gem mentioned in the Torah as being in the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. So the gem of Ethiopia also is not equal to the value of wisdom. Bechesem tahor lo tisuleh, pure gold shall not be weighed against it. In other words, nothing can match wisdom. That's the bottom line that you're supposed to be taking from this. V'ha-chokhmah me'ayin etavo. So where is wisdom going to come from? He asks. The bottom line out of all of this, so where is it that we're going to find wisdom? V'ezem mekom binah. Where is the place of its understanding, right? You go back to sentence 12, that's what he started with, right? He started the transition from the gems by saying, "V'achokhma me'ayin timatzei." Where is it that wisdom, that knowledge, wisdom, understanding, where are these going to be found? V'ne'elma me'enei kol chai. It is hidden from the eyes of all who live. U'me'och ha'shamayim nistara. It is hidden from the birds of the heavens. Remember, we talked about the birds of the heavens before and their pursuit of the of prey and not being able to see the gems. He says, "Forget it. It's hidden from them." Avadon v'mavet amru be'oznenu shamanu shima. Destruction and death say, we've heard of it. We've heard of it, these places of death. Elokim hevin darka. Actually, I'm going to stop with that. Because once I start on there, they have to get to the conclusion of the chapter. But what is being said here, what he's saying here, again, give it three different approaches. Either he's making a statement to them of, I pursue righteousness, as I said, because I believe in Torah, I don't believe in the pursuit of wealth. Wealth is out there to be found, maybe it's going to be destroyed. Wisdom is above all, and it's very hard to find. You have to be able to pursue Torah in purity and not pursuing life and all the things that we said as we went through this. That's Rashi. Second view, Ibn Ezra's view, Dat Mikra as well, he's debating the visitors. And he's saying, stop trying to tell me you comprehend things. You don't, because wisdom can't be found. Gems, I can tell you where to find gems. Torah, forget it. It's not there. You're not going to find it. So, not Torah, sorry, wisdom. You're not going to find it. And don't tell me that you know why I'm suffering. And then the third view, the Newsom view, is that what it's saying is your whole debate about wisdom is useless. All this debating you've been doing is fundamentally not going to bring you to wisdom. Where will you find wisdom? The next verses that we didn't get to, that we're going to have to read next week, that's where you find wisdom with God, as we'll see. But let me not jump the gun. So please come back ready next week, because we have to finish this chapter. Thank you very much.